This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. To anyone who follows the theater, it would be hard to ignore the recent spate of science on the stage. From Proof to Tooth and Claw to Moving Bodies, the plays aren't just about birds and the bees. They've taken on biology, math, even chaos theory, nuclear physics, and brought them to the stage with terrific success. Science isn't just for the pocket protector set anymore. This hour we'll be talking about science and the stage, and we're broadcasting from one on the stage at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York here in New York City. And given the general public's fear of science, it is truly remarkable how many plays with science-related themes have recently been staged or are in the process of being produced worldwide. So why? Why does science work so well in the theater? And what does it take to bring science to a larger audience, to the theater crowd? Does the science in the script really matter, or is the play the thing, the storyline? And how can you create a successful drama without portraying scientists as geeks or those crazy-haired, absent-minded professors Hollywood likes to throw at us? And what about science musicals? Yeah, those are two words you don't often hear together. We'll talk about the challenges of writing music about science, and we'll audition a few numbers from science musicals, one already from a successful play called Fermat's Last Tango, and one from a musical in the works, Einstein's Dreams. So how do you get a musical, especially one about science produced for the theater? A producer is here. He'll tell us how he's doing it. We're broadcasting this hour from the Prochansky Auditorium at the Graduate Center at City University here in Manhattan. And if you're in the audience today, I invite you to step up to the microphones to ask your questions. We'd be very happy to. You could take time now, and first time maybe you'll ever get to talk to a theater producer. Also, if you're listening on the radio or on the web, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic today. Let me introduce my guest. Brian Schwartz is a professor in the Department of Physics at City University of New York. He's also Vice President for Research at the Graduate Center and co-director of New Media Laboratory, the New Media Laboratory here. Thanks for being with us, Brian. Arthur Giron is a founding member of the Ensemble Studio Theater and a playwright. His plays include Edith Stein, Flight, and Moving Bodies. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Jay Holtham is the program director for the Ensemble Studios Theater's Sloan Project.
Hi,
Jay. And Joshua Rosenblum is a pianist and a conductor. He is also composer and co-lyricist for Fermat's Last Tango and Einstein's Dreams. And he's with us also. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Brian, how does a physicist cross over to being a theater entrepreneur?
Well, I think I've always been interested in sort of bringing science to the public, and I actually got started in this business when I was the director of the Centennial Program for the American Physical Society. They were celebrating their 100th anniversary in 1999, and I sort of had to help them produce this. And one of the things that I did was produce the first ever physics festival held in any city, and the festival consisted of working with scientists and the arts and the city. And so, for example, we did the physics of ballet with the Atlanta Ballet. Mm-hmm. We did a play, Schrodinger's Girlfriend, really, again, for the public. We did the physics of fractals with the Heim Museum. So I got involved in reaching out to the public, and it turns out that that plays are a very good way of doing it because you reach a terrific audience. The audience is not only scientist audience if it's a play about science, but often there's history, there are ethical issues, good storylines, personal issues.
Well, what do you have to have in a good play? And I asked all of you this. What, is it the science, or is it the storyline, or are there plays that have all different, that are on, you know, in production and going to be in production that have different ones?
I'll let Arthur answer that. He's a real playwright.
It's the same for any play. It doesn't matter if it's a science play or not. You have to have a very interesting question, you know, in your mind. Mm-hmm. And for example, I did a play about Richard Feynman, the physicist. And I knew he was a very sexual guy, but he fell in love with a woman who couldn't have sex. And so right away, I want to know what's going on here. He happened to have been one of the great teachers, I think, even more than a physicist. I think of him as a teacher. But I got into it to find out the answer. Why was he attracted to this woman and what happened? So it is the human aspect and the question that the play is asking
So you have to have a good storyline.
Yes, can't. Of course. Yes.
Jay, you're shaking your head. You're not going to be just teaching science to people.
No, right? That's really boring, and people don't want to sit through it, even people who are interested in science. But what's also important, in addition to the human story, it's got to be a compelling play, something people are going to want to watch. But we also have to try to make sure that the science is as full as it can be. And is right on, because one thing that I've found is that the scientists are very sharp, and as soon as they hear anything that's even remotely wrong, they're gone. They're gone out the
room. And you care about that.
Very much so. Very much. We want to reach the science community. It's out there. They're fascinating people, and they're really interested in the arts, and no one ever really seems to reach out to them.
Josh, as a composer, a pianist, a lyricist, how do you decide your topic that you're going to write about? And do you agree with Jay that when you write the lyrics or the music, it has to be dead on, accurate, or can you take a bit of literary license with this?
I think people respect you more if you're accurate, and I would add to what Jay said that not only are they out the door, they're all over you. They're waiting after the show for you with their 6 pages of notes. I mean, Fermat's Last Tango, which was my show about Andrew Wiles and the proving of Fermat's Last Theorem, these mathematicians would come up to me after the show and talk to me about all these branches of abstract mathematics that I had no idea what they were talking about. But they just assumed, since I had written this show, that I was conversant in...
So you don't have to be a scientist to write any of these plays.
No, but you do have to do your homework. And we
Jane,
did.
Yeah. Ira, may I mention
sure.
something? The title of my play about Feynman is called Moving Bodies, which is a metaphor. I mean, as we know, moving bodies are atoms, right? But the play is also about moving bodies, literally, so that it's where you do the poetic choices to be able to be more clear about the science, to find some metaphors and that anybody can understand. Yeah.
Copenhagen was like that a little bit, the way they moved around, sort of around the nucleus of an atom on stage.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, Michael Frayn in the staging, the director really viewed Bohr's wife as sort of the central person that was communicated to about the science. Both Heisenberg and Bohr would speak with her. And then, in fact, they moved in emotion very much like she was the center nucleus, and they walked around her like an atom. And, in fact, I watched some of the staging in which not only do the electrons have electrical properties, but they have spin, and one would turn one way, the other one would turn the other way.
Right?
It was that sophisticated, but no one would notice it except a physicist.
So there were different levels in it.
There were different levels. Yes,
you could. It's like re-seeing a movie over and over again. And you go pick something else out of it.
Absolutely,
if you know what to look for.
And it's also like for scientists, it's seeing a movie about something that you know really intimately. So you'll get little inside jokes that someone else will just go by. We've had plays go on where the scientist bursts out in laughter at something that everyone else in the audience is like, huh?
We had that experience too. We could always tell when there were mathematicians in the audience. There was uproarious laughter in places where there was dead silence on the nights.
Well, are you getting more than just scientists coming, the public in general coming to these plays?
You have to. That's the whole point, is to open it up to the public at large and prove that even if they aren't mathematicians or scientists or physicists, that they're universal, compelling issues that are going to be of interest to everybody. That's the key.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We invite you to ask questions by phone or step up to the microphones here in our audience at the Graduate Center, CUNY Graduate Center. Is science, and you look at different plays and you see how science is treated. In some plays, it's treated just as a metaphor to talk about other things, right? In other plays, you actually look at the science. Is there a trend in either direction, Jay, would you say?
I wouldn't say there is. There's sort of two very different schools of thought about it. There are lots of plays that come out focusing on one thing or the other. We've done both. We've gone from, plays that are very serious bio plays. It all depends on the interest of the artist involved. Josh said something interesting. I think it matters for audience as well as artists, that there is that big science fear about it. It's all this world that's impenetrable. And the artists who want to penetrate that world find their ways in. And for some, it's just the metaphors of it. And for others, it's the very specific life and times and work of a very specific scientist.
Josh, speaking of that, your musical from Fermat's Last Tango had a successful run in Portugal.
Thank you so much for mentioning that.
But why? What? Tell us how it was received over there.
It's a national cultural phenomenon.
If you say so yourself, that's right.
I'm being completely objective here. It was much better received there than it was here. It was on the front page of the most widely read newspaper in the country. The president of the country has been there. The president has a vested interest himself in not only theater, but theater that educates and theater that's related to science. So they're nuts about it over there.
Is it on its way over here sometime?
We're working on it.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can get a quick phone call in here before the break. Let's go to David in Redwood, California. Hi, David.
Hello. I've composed an opera based on Apollo 14, mission to the moon, and one of my attractions to it, to science in general, as a composer, I also have an undergraduate degree in physics, but one of my attractions to science in a musical setting is just the quality of the jargon. It's just so interesting. The rhythm of the words, the kinds of words are very suggestive to me. So I have a question to the panel. How do you deal with jargon? Do you revel in it? Do you simplify it? What do you do with it?
Josh?
That's a really good question. Several reviews of Fermat's Last Tango said that it was hard to imagine that they would ever again hear the words Shimura Taniyama conjecture set to music.
and rhymed as well.
What?
And rhymed as well.
That's right. It does present lots of possibilities in terms of the sounds of unusual words. You have to be careful not to alienate your audience, but you know, if used sparingly and with attention to the sound as well as the meaning of the words, it can definitely open up a whole world of possibilities. He's absolutely right.
David, where is your musical headed?
Well, it's an opera. A bit of it was presented by New York City Opera in their showcasing works, Vox 2002. Right now, my opera is still looking for a full performance, and my last name is MECKLE. Music on the web, you'll find my website.
Send us an email. Send us an email. We'll forward it to the right parties. Thanks for calling.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care. 1-800-989-8255. There is latent audience. I mean, they're out there, Brian.
Yeah, in fact, since we've been doing, for the last 3 years, we've been doing science and the arts here, where we've been doing science and plays, science and music, science and dance, in fact. And a lot of people have begun noticing us and begin sending us material. I recently got some material from the person who wrote the play Lenny on a opera about Fritz Haber, the German scientist who invented the poison gas and all. And so just a lot of things are happening. People have approached us, and we view ourselves here at the Graduate Center as a venue for presenting these materials. We actually do staged readings. It's a very good way of getting it before the public.
Well, why the flood now, do you think? Is there the right time? Jay?
I really think that it has a lot to do with sort of the tech revolution of the late 90s and how much more science and technology became an everyday part of everyone's world, and also the leaps that we made. You know, there was the first cloning, and all of those things just created a sort of groundswell of information, interest in the information, an interest in the world of science in general, to try to understand better what are these new forces that are affecting our lives.
Is there an affinity group for all the composers and playwrights who focus on science? Do they talk to each other? Do they, you know, a website or something?
Well, there's, you know, what we do over at the EST Sloan Project is sort of a central hub for it, you know, bring people in and out. But no, they're sort of, people are in weird pockets. They're out there. A lot of them are scientists themselves. Just working alone in their labs, creating theater.
Mm-hmm. Right. We have a proposal into the National Science Foundation to sort of create a center for science and the arts, and would really like to be able to work with Sloan, the Ensemble Studio Theater, and others across the nation. There are actually real pockets of people doing very exciting things.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to hear Josh play for us and some audition some music from one of his plays. So stay with us and be ready to be entertained. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about science on stage. With me is Brian Schwartz, professor in the Department of Physics, City University of New York. He's also vice president for research at the Graduate Center and co-director of the New Media Lab. Arthur Giron is a playwright whose works include Flight and Bodies in Motion. Shay Holtham is the program director for the Ensemble Studio Theater's Sloan Project. And now we're going to have a treat, a Science Friday treat. At the piano is Joshua Rosenberg. He is Rosenblum. He is joined by Tom Beckett and Michael McCoy, and we're going to be listening to Joshua's composition, Love is Not a Science, from the musical Einstein's Dreams.
Love? How can you be in love with a woman who exists only in your dreams?
I know, it sounds crazy. Why can't love be more like physics?
Pity poor Albert Einstein, the brightest young mind around. His path-breaking notion of Brownian motion is widely considered profound. He showed why we wanta define light as quanta.
Oh.
I have to admit, that was smart. But like me and like you, he hasn't a clue when it comes to affairs of the heart. Regrettably, love is not a science. It practically bursts with sheer defiance. The head and the heart are a misalliance. Somebody should sue for non-compliance. Love is not schematic. Its shape and its form are too erratic. Though nature wants us to pause for love, she didn't provide any laws for love, and as a result, it's problematic.
Thank you, my good friend Besso, for putting me in my place. You proved that my mind is the limited kind, and you made quite an eloquent case. Your views are extensive and so comprehensive. Your point is undoubtedly true. Successful advancing in love and romancing requires a moron like you. Regrettably, love allows no measure. It weakens your mind and spoils your leisure. Though many have found it a thing to treasure, I find that it only creates displeasure. Love is but ephemeral, on which there is clearly no reliance. Though Freud may talk of the id of love, if I could only be rid of love, I'd jump for joy and stick to science. In matters of love, you're always defenseless. There's nothing to keep love from attacking and beating you senseless.
It's easy to find somebody you'd like to live in sin with,
but then love disappears as fast as it came to begin with.
Regrettably, love is not astronomy.
It has no design and lacks economy.
You can't attend any school for love, which means you're always a fool for love, and we'd rather retain complete autonomy. Love is not
empirical. Right. It isn't convex, oblong,
or spherical. It's usually soft and vague and lyrical.
Oh, emerging alive requires a miracle.
Love creates dependence, and it makes you abandon self-reliance. Though some have applauded the joys,
we just want to be free of the noise,
so we can lounge with the boys and conquer science.
All right. Thank you. Wow. Tom Beckett, Michael McCoy singing Love is Not a Science from the musical Einstein's Dreams. Joshua Rosenblum accompanying them on the piano, and the lyrics. You wrote the lyrics and the music for that, Joshua?
My wife and collaborator, Joanne Lessner, and I co-wrote the lyrics, and I wrote the music. And I should also add, the musical is based on the marvelous novel Einstein's Dreams by Alan Lightman.
How do you, when you sit down to write the lyrics, what goes through your mind, the kind of words? I mean, I almost hear a little bit of Tom Lyra in there. You know, any influence from him at all, the grand, great-granddaddy of all science music?
I feel very flattered that you said that. Tom Lyra is absolutely brilliant. Frequently overlooked when people name great lyricists, people name Alan J. Lerner, Ira Gershwin, mm-hmm. Cole Porter, those people are amazing, but Tom Lehrer should be on that list too. Please. And the fact that you mentioned my name in the same sentence as his, I consider an honor.
Gee. So answer the question. Did he influence your work?
Influence is a tricky subject, and we could have a whole program about that. So it's hard to say yes or no, but I think the fact that I know his work well and admire him, and if you heard it, I think that says in itself is an answer.
Mm-hmm. And when you collaborated with your wife on the song, were you on the same frequency on this? That you have to figure out I'm trying to understand how a musical is made in science. I mean, do you have different sensibilities that you go through if you're doing a musical about science or a musical about something else, you know, about the producers or something like that?
It's a similar process, I think, whatever the subject is, except for science, usually it involves more research than it might otherwise. That song didn't really require research. That's more of a novelty-type number. It doesn't really go into explanations. It's more like a buddy song, sort of one-upsmanship between two science friends who are each trying to be smarter than the other by increasing the number of rhymes that they can make for obscure words.
Brian?
What should be realized is that Josh and Joanne really picked up on the novel by Alan Lightman, which deals with concepts of time. And it's a very difficult novel in a sense to make a musical out of, let alone a play out of, because it really deals with about 30 different vignettes of how time could be. Einstein in 1905 thinking about it. So time can move backwards, time can stop, time can break up into three dimensions. And what they've taken is a very careful reading of the play, created an arc of a story, and then made it into a musical using many of the metaphors that Alan Lightman has in his beautiful book.
Well, you, for lack of a better word, and you told me this yourself, you are the producer at this point of Einstein's dreams. You're the point man on this, right?
Right. Well, it's you know, I've actually always tried to like produce and make things happen. So the fact that I'm producing a miracle musical is really quite something.
How is it harder to quote unquote sell this idea because it's about science to a theater producer who will eventually put it on the stage someplace?
I think it's easier, in my view, to get a lot of attention, especially using the word Einstein in the title. In fact, the year 2005 is going to be the International Year of Physics, in which there's going to be a celebration worldwide to celebrate the anniversary of the 100th anniversary of Einstein's miracle year in 1905. So I think a good title, and then he picked another good title for Mars Last Tango, a good title, a good musical, and a good issue, and a good basic, in this case, a very good basic novel, makes for a good foundation.
I should add that Fermat's Last Tango was a very difficult sell, because every time I said the title, it had to be accompanied with a 20-minute explanation of who Fermat was and who Andrew Wiles was and the story of the proof. But Einstein's Dreams instantly evokes images for just about everybody, I think.
Arthur Girona, Moving Bodies, is it hard to get that, you know, attention for that because it's got of its theme?
Well, you know, let me step back a little bit. The first one was about the Wright brothers when they were children, and that's Flight. And, you know, people would say, well, what are you working on? And I'd say the Wright brothers, but when they were children. So the angle there is that they were children because I wanted to find out. My question was, how does genius happen in a family? But like Brian was mentioning about Einstein next year, this last year, 2003, was the centennial of the first flight, and it helped a great deal. I mean, there's a tremendous interest in because of the centennial of the Wright brothers. And so that I did not have a problem because, I mean, it's not Fermat is not the Wright brothers, and so that... I mean, Josh is clearly much more intelligent than I am. And so I don't think I could do that, but it's easier to do the Wright brothers. Because
I can understand that, yeah. Let's go to the audience, take a call right here. Step up to the mic. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Jose, and I'm a student here at the Graduate Center in chemistry. And I also play the piano and the pipe organ. And I was thinking that for many of us who are scientists and do music, the appeal of the common link of math is there. And I was wondering for Joshua, in terms of composing, how conscious you are of that common link of math between science and music.
It's a good question. There is definitely a strong affinity between math and music. And I've tried experimenting with various systems of relating numbers to pitches and seeing how that would turn up in the music. But it doesn't really create anything in terms of the content or the emotional content of any numbers. So I think that end of it, at least in terms of theater, is always going to be theoretical. And in Einstein's Dreams, I actually tried experimenting with playing music backwards to simulate time moving backwards, but that doesn't work either. No one could ever tell. So the backwards number actually turned out, what we did was run the lyrics backwards, and then everyone could tell that the song was backwards. But running the music backwards had no effect whatsoever. So it is a link, but it's not really useful in terms of theater, I'm finding.
Jay Halton? Did you sorry. Go ahead, Arthur. Arthur,
yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Jose, don't go away yet. A very interesting thing I have found is that many scientists are musicians, painters, writers, the way Chekhov was a doctor, but he was also a great playwright. And so that, can you have it all? Yes, you can. You can live your life as an artist and be a scientist. And one of the things that we're hoping will break down now in our time are these classifications and barriers, because in Voltaire's time, Voltaire was a scientist and a playwright and a philosopher, and it didn't matter. But nowadays, people are telling us, no, you can only be one thing. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be just one thing. You can be a musical person and a mathematician.
Let me go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Elizabeth on the Jersey Turnpike. Hi, Elizabeth.
Well,
are you there?
Thank you for having me. Yes, I am. Can you hear me all right? I'm on my cell phone.
Can you hear me? Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. First of all, I just wanted to say that I hope that they'll bring Einstein's dreams to Princeton and ask Emily Mann to direct it. They
would
should definitely contact
her
at MacArthur Theater.
Would you please have a word with Emily for me?
I will, actually. I know her. My name is Elizabeth Picard, and I just wanted to say that I come from a line of physicists and scientists. My grandfather, Jean-Félix Picard, went into space in the stratosphere with my grandmother piloting him, and he knew Einstein well and actually had translated a lot for him. He was Swiss and used to translate for him. And the scientists that I've known, and I know lots now and growing up in the family, were all amazingly funny and wonderful people. And for people to be afraid of science, if they knew scientists, if they knew physicists, they're some of the funniest people that you'll ever meet. If anyone's read Surely You're Joking, Dr. Feynman, it was a hilarious book, and he was an amazing man. So I think it's great that they're bringing these things to the stage, and people will be drawn to science just by the nature of the personalities of these scientists, and also the interesting connection of how the way physics is going. It's sort of a cosmic thing. They see that it's almost becoming a spiritual science as well, with certain connections. So, I think it's great what they're doing, and that's all I wanted to say.
Well, Arthur has a question.
I have a question, Elizabeth. How did it happen that your mother went into space with your father?
My grandfather, actually.
Your grandfather.
My grandmother.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Is that Jean-Luc Picard?
No, well, actually, there was a connection. Roddenberry was a fan of my grandfather's as a child, and he named the character Jean-Luc instead of Jean Picard. He told my sister because he didn't want to pay the family money because his name was Jean-Félix. So I guess there was a connection. But my grandfather, and I had a twin brother, Auguste, and the two of them were scientists. They were Swiss. And they invented, they actually built the first pressurized cabin, and his brother, Auguste, and my grandfather made stratosphere flights. And the real big stratosphere flight that my grandfather made, my grandmother was his pilot. She had her master's in chemistry. She had been a student. She went to Bryn Mawr.
I think there's a movie or a musical or something here.
It's a musical. I'm taking notes.
Well, actually, I'm writing her biography. I'm in the process of going to the Library of Congress. There's lots, 27 linear feet of documents there for our family.
Elizabeth, I'd like to... this is Arthur Jerome. I would very much like to continue talking about this. I think it's fabulous.
I get 10% of whatever.
You get 10%.
Whatever is going on.
The Graduate Center gets another 10%.
Let me say one other thing. It turns out that scientists are funny.
It's quite a story.
Well, can be funny. And
you're breaking up, so I'm going to have to say goodbye, but we'll talk to you later.
Now about 100 plays about science, some of them being musicals, some of them being operas, but they're actually science comedies, one of being Steve Martin's Picasso et le Panagile, and then actually Matt Wells' Schrodinger's Girlfriend. So there are many different types of science plays. And in fact, this next semester on March 1st here at the Graduate Center, we're going to do something called Science Vaudeville, where we're going to have...
No kidding.
So it's...
Next when?
On March 1st here at the Graduate Center.
Well, I'll have to write that down.
Okay.
All right, 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about science on the stage this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's get a woman here in the audience to ask a question.
Hi, my name is Eve Klein. I'm a student here in New York as well. I know that the professional theater doesn't have much of an audience from young people my age. I'm sorry to say that, but it is the case. Do any of you have plans to, or do you see others with plans to, draw science into other mediums, like television, for example?
That's a really, really good question, and that's very much one of the things we, as an arm of the Sloan Foundation, one of their big things is the public understanding of science, and that's their goal, is to make sure people understand as much about science as possible. So that's and ours as well. You know, we want to reach as many people. We want our plays to go on to be movies and TV films and all of that to sort of spread the gospel. Mm-hmm. I think sort of along the lines of what Elizabeth was saying about how her family is really funny and no one seems to realize that. No one seems to connect the idea of scientists being human people who have all range of emotions. We're very much stuck in the stereotype of the egghead geek scientist either being the mad scientist or the nutty professor.
Why are there no TV? I know people have been trying to get a TV series for years.
Exactly. Leon Letterman, who's a very funny scientist in his own right and a Nobel Prize winner, really wanted to get a program very much like you had L.A. Law, which was a series about lawyers and their foibles, and he was trying to get, in an alliterated way, the Philadelphia Physicist. But he never got off the ground with that one.
And I know Leon for many years. He's been trying to do this for at least 20 years, and he can't get, he's tried to talk to producers and people out in Hollywood.
If I had to guess, I think one of the problems is that scientists are very poor consumers. I mean, so when you want to have an audience that consists of science and really have ads and commercials, most scientists have a car at least 15 years old. I think it's fairly new.
But they're not looking for that audience. They're looking for a general public audience, right? Josh, maybe?
But the sponsors.
The sponsors are looking for that. Something will come out of this. Josh, working on any other new music at all?
Yes, I'm working on Halliburton the musical based on the news lead-in to the program today.
Okay, 1-800-999-8255 is a number. Halliburton the musical. It sort of have a technology bent to it.
Yes, exactly.
All right, we're gonna have to go away and take a short break. We'll come back and talk lots more with Brian Schwartz, Arthur Giron, Jay Holtham, and Joshua Rosenblum about science and the theater. And take your questions. And if you've got any, stay on the line. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note. Join Neil Conan on Monday in this hour for a look at Republican and Democrat records on spending and how each party hopes to make it an election year issue. This hour, we're talking about science on the stage, and as I say, we are on the stage at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York, and we're now going to turn over to the Steinway. Sitting at the Steinway is Joshua Rosenblum, and he is joined by Edward Dean Cowan, who's going to sing Math Widow, a song from the musical for Matt's Last Tango.
Daniel, dear, look at me. See, I brought you a cup of tea. Nothing. Daniel, dear, here I am. Would you like buttered scones with jam? Nothing. My presence doesn't register, it's clear. I sometimes wonder if I'm even here. Math, widow, that's what I am. That's what I'll always be. What's the big commotion about an X or a Y? A cosine or the square root of 3? There's a kind of pleasure only I can provide. It's not so hard to see. What's in a cube or a square that I don't share? And why'd you rather spend your time with them than me? More and more I regret life resembles the empty set. Nothing. Time goes by, no one grieves. Zero taken from zero leaves. Nothing. When I had math in grade school, I recall I hated long division most of all. Math! widow has a nice ring could be my epitaph. How'd you like to take a break to check out some curves that aren't the kind you plot on a graph? Worse than Albert Einstein on a permanent search for relativity. What's in this Gordian knot that gets you hot? And how can it compare to what you're missing with me? Topology of surfaces is boring, unless, of course, the surface is me. And I have no compunctions about symmetric functions. I'll show you one that operates continuously. Man, widow, that's what I am. Nobody's Valentine. I'll bet you'll never find a single modular form it's nearly as appealing as mine. Temperature is rising and frustration's increasing exponentially. And if the day ever comes when all of these sums exceed infinity, I'll say so long, kiddo, and to your proof, ditto. My days of being mad.
All right. Edward Dean Cowan singing Math Widow, a song from the musical From Us Last Tango. Joshua Rosenblum at the piano. And in case you didn't know better, this is Science Friday. Even though we're coming today from, you may have tuned in, hearing the music, having a wonderful time and not know it's Science Friday. We're here at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York with Brian Schwartz, who's professor of physics in the Department of Physics at City University, and also Vice President for Research at the Graduate Center and co-director of the New Media Laboratory. Arthur Giron, playwright. His plays include Flight and Moving Bodies. Jay Holtham is the program director for the Ensemble Studio Theater's Sloan Project, and Joshua Rosenblum is a pianist, conductor, is also the composer and co-lyricist for the musicals From Oz, Last Tango, and Einstein's Dreams. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Lots of people want to talk about this. I think we've discovered, I've seen from the phones, a lot of closet musicians, scientists who are ready to come out and say that they are really, you know, into music. Let's go to the phone. Let's go to Ruth in Syracuse. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, go ahead.
I think a very important interface for science and theater is in the medical field. I'm a physician here in upstate New York, and for over 15 years I've been using our professional theater, Syracuse Stage, with students at SUNY Upstate Medical Center. We regularly take students to the theater. Our upcoming play will be Stones in His Pockets, where we're going to look at rural and urban healthcare delivery issues. So not so much around a science issue, but around a healthcare delivery issue. But for example, we've also used Miss Evers' Boys by David Feldshu, and such things as Elephant Man to talk about disability, and Lesson Before Dying to talk about literacy issues. So I just think this is a wonderful area to use in medicine.
Mm-hmm. Any comments from my panels? Joshua?
I think that this is a huge area to develop grant-wise to have interactions with theater and medicine. For example, to really incorporate in the community that these are your medical students are future supporters of theater, and that you can hit topics in medicine so keenly and give clinical insight, almost a crystallization of what a doctor experiences through theater.
I want to make a point that David Feldshu, who wrote Miss Evers' Boys, is a doctor, an emergency room doctor, and yet he goes home and writes a play. And so he's an example of how you can do both things.
Thanks for calling, Ruth.
Yeah.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go right here to this woman by the mic. Yes, go ahead.
My name's Jill Kwartz. I'm a psychologist as well as a musician, so sort of follows along with what a lot of the people are saying. But in psychology, and I am very opinionated, so a lot of people may disagree, but I think like in the theater or film, psychologists invariably wind up sleeping with their patients, and that's sort of a stereotype that perpetuates despite maybe a few unusual movies. But I was just wondering, in terms of cultural pressures, as science interfaces the theater, do you feel those kind of pressures?
To sleep with my patients?
Jay?
In terms of hard science, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is, it's been really interesting working with this project over the last few years and sort of seeing the, getting an understand of the cultural image of scientists and how it's really changed. You know, towards further back in the towards the beginning of the century, science was going to save everybody.
Right.
Science was going to extend everyone's life. It was a wonderful thing. And pretty much when you get to the point of the A-bomb and all of the very complicated issues that arise out of that, scientists sort of made this shift into mad, evil people and geeks that are off in the corners. And, I mean, it's the hardest thing. I think we were talking about theater producers. That's sort of the hardest thing for, I think, anyone to get over the hump of, like, why would you make a play about a scientist? They can't possibly be interesting, or they can't possibly say anything that I can understand.
Mm-hmm. But the fact that scientists are searching for an answer to something, searching for the truth like philosophers and mm-hmm. other people are, isn't that really a ripe area? There's conflict, there's, you know, and because the public thinks, and we've talked about this from day one, that the scientists, quote, know things. They know everything, and the things are written down in stone. And when they find out that they don't, that this is a moving target
that we're talking about. They get disappointed in the scientists.
Yeah, and but it also would be a good grist for theater and, you know, even musicals, Brian.
I think, again, here we get into, like, when people were looking at the turn of the century, and I think this is why science has come to the prominence again, is most people have agreed that this past century was a century of physics. Mm-hmm. And everyone's thinking that the next century will be a century of biology. When they ask journalists, like, what was the most important journalistic event of the 20th century, it ended up being the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima was number one, and about 30 of the major events of the 20th century ended up being science or technology related. And I think now we're sort of, the technology is here with us, and it raises just a tremendous amount of issues. And what's very good about many of the science plays is they combine theater, science, but then also history, and then ethics, and all sorts of issues come up, and so you can use it, and we are trying to use it as a teaching technique for really getting humanists and scientists together to cross the two cultures of C.P. Snow.
Mm. We're talking about science and the theater this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Does anybody actually try to teach real science in any of these plays? Instead of using it as a metaphor, I mean, Jay?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, because for most of the plays, some understanding of what the science is necessary to getting mm-hmm. the story. So there's always a lot of really serious science, and there's a lot of factual information that gets passed on. It's rare that people want to just purely educate. I mean, we're primarily interested in things that are, you know, entertaining theater, not educational theater. But you have to get the audience up to speed because they're not really going to understand, you know, the intricacies of string theory.
But they do want to know. The audience wants to know. I have a scene, for example, where Robert Oppenheimer wants to hire Richard Feynman to go to Los Alamos, and he wants to find out if Feynman can explain things to the non-scientists. And then, naturally, the scene then becomes about how, you know, what makes a tree. So I put it there so that the audience would learn what makes a tree, but it also shows that Feynman can talk clearly, and Oppenheimer gives him the job.
And the audience must get a little bit of satisfaction knowing that, you know,
that's
a positive feeling.
Yeah, right.
And the play gets a reputation. Hey, you know, I actually learned something.
Right, absolutely.
They feel as smart as the scientists for a couple of
hours.
Absolutely. What's interesting now is many colleges really choose a book that they ask all the freshmen to read over the summer, and then all the freshmen have a common experience coming in there. And they've, in the past, chosen some pretty heavy books that are very hard to read and maybe one-dimensional. It might be about history. It might be about some kind of cultural aspect. Last summer, we spent some time at Lafayette College, really, where all the students were assigned to play Copenhagen. And it's a nice, you know, it's only 100 pages, so the students may really actually get to read it. In addition to that, they had the teachers in an interdisciplinary way from history, ethics, biology, physics, and all, meet with the students before. Then we actually had a production of the play, and then meet with them afterwards. And it was really one of the few books that you can really say that a whole faculty was really happy. because the faculty competes. What should be the book that the students reads over the summer? Mm-hmm. And this was a book that had it all.
You can all different levels they can participate in talking
yes.
about. Yes, sir. Let's go to the mic over here. Yes,
I'm Frank Henschke from the Martin Siegel Theater Center here at the Graduate Center. A question for Brian Schwartz. Arts and science are supposed to be free in our society. Still, science seems to move also in a very dangerous direction, cloning, nuclear weapons, DNA manipulations. Would scientists be better scientists if they would be required to study plays or see plays that deal with moral or ethical implications of their own work?
Yeah, I think that would be a very good way of doing things, because then they meet the people and the public in a way about a topic in which the public had its own say. In other words, it wasn't only science. So I think that would be a good way of doing things.
Jay, yeah?
I actually kind of disagree with that a little bit, just because what I found is the scientists are very aware of these plays. They see plays, they see art, and they're very aware also of the moral issues of the work they do. Those are actually some of the more interesting science plays even that explore that complicated nature. I think it's more a concern on the general society to understand how a scientist can make something like the atom bomb and feel like a scientist. Like, what's the drive there, as opposed to feeling like they're just making something purely evil. And I don't understand how you can make something purely evil when there are a lot of complicated forces that are involved there.
Mm-hmm. I just got a couple of minutes left. I want to ask each of you. I'll start with you, Jay. What's on your plate next? Have you got something?
We're right now in the process of planning our first Light Festival, which we do every year in April, which will have a main stage production at its heart. Right now we're planning to do Tooth and Claw by Michael Hollinger.
What's that about?
It's about a biologist working at the Darwin Research Center in the Galapagos Islands, mm-hmm. And gets involved in local politics.
All right. So, okay, quickly, and yep. Arthur, what's on your...
A new play about Voltaire and his mistress, who was a physicist, Emily du Châtelet, who translated Newton into French.
And Joshua, I know you're working on that other thing, but...
Right, yes. Also trying to finish Einstein's Dreams and bring the Lisbon production of Fermat's Last Tango back to the U.S. in English.
Brian?
And here we have a science and art series for the spring semester, which can be found on the web, which... if you go to IRISCITE, he'll point to you in that direction. And also trying to get money from the National Science Foundation, which is always a job.
Well, thank you very much, all. We've run out of time. I guess Brian Schwartz, professor in the Department of Physics at City University of New York. He's also vice president for research at the Graduate Center and co-director of the New Media Laboratory. Also with us is Arthur Giron, who is a playwright whose works include Flight and Moving Bodies. Jay Holtham is program director for the Ensemble Studio Theater's Sloan Project. And we've also been joined by Joshua Rosenblum, who's a playwright, author, and from Mott's Last Tango, and also other stuff that's going to be coming out. Pay attention, and we'll be here have you back when your next play is out. We have to go. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.